The following program is produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.
I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Robert Putnam, the author of Bowling Alone and the new book on religion in America, American Grace. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. Two Jewish is sponsored this morning by Temple Emmanuel, a Reformed Jewish community for all of Tucson. Call 327-4501 for information on Arizona's finest synagogue, the only full-service Reformed congregation in southern Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. We're in the end-of-the-year season, a time of holiday overload in America. Oddly, even though Hanukkah was over back on December 9th, lots of people continue to wish me Happy Hanukkah, or I should say, Happy Hanukkah. And while I'm tempted to respond and Happy Thanksgiving to you, I always say instead, Happy Holidays, or sometimes even Merry Christmas. After all, joyful holidays should be fun and celebrated as such by those to whom they apply. So, free of competition from Hanukkah this year, all the media focus falls inevitably on the overwhelmingly popular festival of Christmas, which is the theoretical birthday of Jesus, celebrated as such since between 150 and 300 years after his death. No one actually knows the real date of the birth. The New Testament isn't specific enough even about the month, but what the heck? This is what Western civilization has been focused on for a long time. And while some Christians have tried to limit Christmas celebrations, under Cromwell, the Puritan English Parliament even banned Christmas celebration for a few years, it is still, you know, kind of popular. However, it's not necessarily popular with everyone, including, oddly, some Christians. I mean, there's a great deal of pressure on folks during the holidays, especially this one. While we Jews have lots of festivals to celebrate, and some of them, like Hanukkah, are actually very long, American Christians are sadly limited to Easter and Christmas, mostly. And Christmas is by far the bigger deal in popular culture, if not religiously. Of course, being Jewish can be challenging. The Yiddish phrase is Schwer zu sein Jid. But for some folks, and in some ways, it's kind of a relief not to be Christian during Christmas. As a very silly song puts it, all I want for Christmas is to be Jewish.
All I want for Christmas is to be Jewish. Santa, won't you please be a rabbi? This day would be so easy if I get Hanukkah a try. All I want for Christmas is to be Jewish. Can someone tell me, please, why we cut down these trees and decorate them with a bunch of lights?
It's a fire hazard, I tell you.
I work hard every day. I spend it on my pay, exchanging gifts that we don't even like.
Thanks for the sweater. What is this, velvet?
All I want for Christmas is to be Jewish. I hope I can enlist or justify. I'm thinking about those gifts that I will never have to buy. All I want for Christmas is to be Jewish. Don't mean to generalize, but you know those Jewish guys, they work so hard and they're kind of smart. And if they think it's wise, I will get circumcised. But I wish that I had done it from the start.
Oy, 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 oy.
All I want for Christmas is to be Jewish.
So let's take a moment to commiserate with our suffering Christian friends in this high-pressured holiday season, now that we're done with ours, and wish them well in weathering the turbulent seas of the festival. Now, what do we Jews do on Christmas? The truth is that on December 25th, my daughter Sipora's birthday, by the way, so Jesus wasn't the only Jew born that day, most commercial establishments are closed. If you really want to know what Jews do on Christmas Day, you can just ask a nominee for the U.S. Supreme Court, as Senator Lindsey Graham of Florida did of Elena Kagan during her recent confirmation hearings.
I just ask you where you're at on Christmas.
You know, like all Jews, I was probably at a Chinese restaurant.
Great answer.
Ah, yes, the inevitable Jewish trip to the only open establishment around, the Chinese restaurant. Boy, do they clean up on December 25th. In fact, you could hold a really good minyan in most Chinese places that day, and this year it falls on Shabbos yet. Well, in other news, my friend Rabbi Joe Black will be in town this week helping lead services at Temple Emmanuel, my own congregation in Tucson, Arizona, next Friday night, December 24th. To play us in this morning, here's his setting from the Shabbat liturgy, Yismechu, celebrating the commandment of the Sabbath.
Yismechu b'malchutcha, shomere Shabbat. Yismechu b'malchutcha, shomere Shabbat. Korek onek ve korek onek yismehu b'malchutcha shomer Shabbat am mekadeshe mekadeshe shevi kulam yisbe'u v'itangu mituvecha yismehu b'malchutcha shomer Shabbat yismehu b'malchutcha shomer Shabbat. Bekore onek, bekore onek, yismehu b'malchutcha, shomer Shabbat. Behashvi'i ratzita bo v'kidashto. Eldad yami, oto karata, zecher lemase v'reishi.
That was Rabbi Joe Black, who will be at Temple Emmanuel here in Tucson, where I live, this coming Friday night for Chardonnay Shabbat services at 5:45 p.m. Come by. When we return in a few moments on Too Jewish, we'll hear from researcher and author Robert Putnam of Harvard, author of the hugely important book Bowling Alone, on just how we experience religion in America. He has a great new book out, American Grace, and he'll tell us what the single most important aspect of American religious life is when we come back on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. I was out and about the other day and noticed one of my favorite ice cream stores was out of business. Not only did it depress me because I was in the mood for mint chocolate chip, but it also got me to thinking, how does a hometown restaurant survive these days in a city changing as fast as Tucson? I mean, we got stores being forced out with big rents and huge chains coming in with even huger advertising budgets. It seems to me a place like Tucson kind of starts to lose its individuality. But don't lose faith. At Mama's, we're still your neighborhood pizza restaurant. If you've got a request or a problem, you don't need to call some fancy office in California. You just call Vinny or me or one of the kids and you're at the top. I'm not kidding. At Mama's, we have great tasting food at hometown prices, and we always will. Mama's Pizza with four convenient locations. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza.
We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish This Morning author Robert Putnam. He's the Peter and Isabel Malkin Professor of Public Policy at Harvard University. He has written one very famous book, Bowling Alone, The Collapse and Revival of American Community, and a new book, plus another one, Better Together, Restoring the American Community. His new book is called American Grace, with his co-author David Campbell, How Religion Divides Us and Unites Us. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning. How are you, Rabbi?
Well, thank you. So in preparing this book, American Grace, what were the biggest surprises for you?
The book is an attempt to provide the most comprehensive and in-depth survey of the role of religion in America over the last half century, how religion affects our civic life, how it both divides us and unites us. America is a very religious country and a very diverse and in some respects increasingly polarized country in religious terms. And most places in the world, the combination of religious commitment, being religiously devout and being religiously diverse, produces mayhem. Think Beirut, think Baghdad, think Bosnia, Belfast, Bombay. America is very devout and very diverse religiously, and yet we were somewhat surprised to find remarkably tolerant across religious lines, not only the lines but among different religions, but between people who are religious and people who are not religious. And so the puzzle of American Grace turns out to be, how did we do that? How did we manage to be devout and diverse and nevertheless tolerant?
Did the Bill of Rights have something to do with that?
It sure did. It sets the broader context within which we work out religious differences in America. But the Bill of Rights has been a constant of our whole history, and yet nevertheless there are periods in which there have been quite virulent attacks across religious lines. Jews have every reason to know that. There's been lots of anti-Semitism in American history. But similarly, during the 19th century, when Catholics came here, there were anti-Catholic riots, and people were killed because of religious differences. Admittedly, not on the same scale as in India, but and that was the same constitution as we have now. At the turn of the 20th century, about 100 years ago, America was about as religiously segregated as Northern Ireland is today, where there's all the religious turmoil there. And yet all through that period, we had the same Bill of Rights. So the Bill of Rights is a necessary condition, I think, for coexistence, but it's not a sufficient condition, and we wanted to look beyond that.
You know, I think also historically about a religious group that people don't think of as being particularly discriminated against, but the Latter-day Saints, the Mormons, by the way, the only people in the world that think Jews are Gentiles, were harshly persecuted, you know.
Oh, yeah, it was a capital offense in some states to be a Mormon.
Right. So we've come a long way from that, and we will explore that and many other questions. It's just a great question to talk about when we come back this morning with Robert Putnam on Too Jewish.
At Handmaker's Senior Day programs, variety and interesting activities help Barbara Sanders really enjoy her time there.
They have a lot of activities that I like to do. They have ceramics, they have painting, they have sewing. We go out to the museums and to the parks, and we also go to the casino.
Handmaker helps seniors and disabled individuals maintain their independence longer than they might otherwise. Handmaker's flexible scheduling makes the Senior Day program very convenient, and Barbara feels right at home.
The staff is very nice. They take good care of you. They'll make sure that you have everything you need.
And there are other benefits, too.
All of my grandchildren have piggy banks that I've made from here, and I have a lot of ceramics in my house now because of here.
Call Handmaker at 322-7035 for more information and a complimentary one-day pass. There are new people and new friends to meet.
They're not just friendships. You know, you actually are a part of a family.
Handmaker Senior Day Program serves all faiths, centrally located on Rosemont, just south of TMC. Call 322-7035.
Would you like to make a difference in this world without costing yourself anything? The Mitzvah Corps of Temple Emmanuel helps people in need with their mortgages and utilities and other emergencies of life. We've helped many people stay in their own homes and keep afloat long enough to get back on their feet. The Mitzvah Corps has virtually no administrative overhead and no long processing for those in emergency situations. Your state tax credit donation of $200 per individual or $400 per family costs you nothing. The Mitzvah Corps is a state tax credit 501c3 philanthropy, and your contribution is deductible right off your state tax bill and can also be used as a federal tax deduction. Consult your tax professional with any questions.
You can help the Mitzvah Corps help people in our community by sending your donation, check or credit card of $200 per individual or $400 per family to the Mitzvah Corps, care of Temple Emmanuel, 225 North Country Club Road, Tucson, Arizona, 85716, or call 520-327-4501 for more information.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at tojewishradio@yahoo.com, T-O-O Jewish Radio, or call 520-327-4501, or visit our website, tojewishradio.com. You can also get CDs of all past and present shows by contacting us through the website, or downloading us from there, or from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular podcasts. In the department of God closes one door but opens a window, here on Too Jewish, we have covered the degradation in the relationship between Israel and Turkey pretty extensively for the last couple of years. It's been highlighted by the increased influence within Turkey of Islamist movements, the cooling of the very close diplomatic, economic, and military relationship that used to stand between Turkey and Israel. It reached a new low after the so-called flotilla incident last spring and the cancellation of all the joint military exercises that had been scheduled between Israel and Turkey. But apparently this sad change has helped work some magic in the diplomatic and economic relationship between Israel and Turkey's historical archenemy, Greece, which has begun developing closer ties to Israel. Greece was long a fierce left-wing critic of Israel and a proponent of Palestinian causes, but it's in a great deal of financial trouble right now, while Israel has weathered the current recession as well as any country on the globe. Associating with another westernized Mediterranean country with amazing tourist sites facing huge Islamic neighbors, well, did I also mention that Israel has a strong economy? That all sounds pretty good to Greece. Israeli tourism to Greece this year has jumped 200% from last year. Most of those Israeli tourists were probably originally headed for Turkey. And you can expect Greek tourism to Israel to jump this year as well. The Greek Prime Minister, George Papandreou, sent firefighting help to Israel during the recent Carmel fire, and he has developed a friendship with Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu. Both are U.S.-educated and speak excellent English, and they have cruised together with their wives on a Greek naval yacht. Sounds nice. It is this younger Papandreou who seems to be reversing the policy decisions of his father, Andreas Papandreou, who once made Greece the most anti-Israel country in Europe during his tenure as prime minister back in the 80s. You know, as a history buff, the most interesting aspect of this change is that Israel and Greece have a cultural relationship that dates back to Alexander the Great, and you can make a reasonable case that American Judaism is kind of an amalgam of Greek and Jewish cultures, with JCCs filled with workout equipment, swimming pools, and sculpture gardens, all Greek specialties borrowed by Jews by way of the YMCAs. And so, to celebrate the freshly developing relationship between Greece and Israel, here's the Sephardic group, Voice of the Turtle, with the Song of the Jews of Thessaloniki, also called Salonika, an ancient and fascinating Greek-Jewish community. The charming El Camino de la Escuela, the Street of the School.
En el camino de la escuela con un mancebo me encontré. Bonjour, lady, le abrí la mano, yo le apreté. Bonjour, lady, le abrí la mano, yo le apreté.
Bonjour, te doy yo en primero por hablar de lo que quiero. Esperanza en ti tengo. Por entero, esperanza en ti tengo que me ames por entero.
En una escuela estuvimos, mismos estudios hicimos, al valor ya nos entremos, a la gente presalimos, al valor ya nos entremos, a la gente
That was The Voice of the Turtle from their CD Under Aegean Moons, a Greek-Jewish song, El Camino de la Scola, in the Ladino language. We welcome our shliach on Israel, our maven, Guy Gelbart. Good morning, Guy.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So last week you started talking about a shift in the philosophy of the Jewish Agency from trying to recruit people to make Aliyah, to move to Israel, to instead, in the communities in which the representatives, the emissaries live, like you, to emphasizing Jewish identity within those communities. It's a big philosophical shift, but the truth is that in America, the effort to get large percentages of American Jews to emigrate to Israel has never been terribly successful. You know, it's been a smallish migration at any time, and a fair amount of them come back, except among some of the ultra-Orthodox community. So this isn't quite such a huge shift in some ways.
Well, I think the main shift is, first of all, because the Jewish Agency is now saying that the main challenge of the Jewish people is to keep the Jewish identity and to keep the young Jewish kids connected to their Judaism. And the Jewish Agency emphasizes that this connection can be done mainly by a connection with Israel, by a bonding with Israel. We saw tremendous effects on unaffiliated young Jewish students that went to Birthright, which is a great project of the Jewish Agency and the Israel government,
right,
taking 18-year-old kids that have never been to Israel to visit Israel for 2 weeks, about 2 weeks, 10-day visit. And although the visit itself doesn't have much of a Jewish identity flavor, it's really doing fun in Israel. Apparently, statistics show that 60% of those unaffiliated teenagers, when they come back to the States, they become affiliated.
Wow.
Which is very interesting.
Very interesting that Judaism, Jewish identity can be forged within Israel, even when people aren't doing terribly Israeli things. Very interesting. Do you, American immigration has always been very low. Is that because things are always pretty good in America and there's never been that sort of desperate desire to move to Israel that comes from many other places?
Well, you know, I should ask you the same that question.
How come I haven't made Aliyah? Rabbi.
But I think in general that the Jewish people at the States haven't been under significant stress that in compared to Europe or to
Argentina or
But we do see, for instance, today we see many people that are doing Aliyah from French,
right?
Because it's not so nice being Jewish in French today. The anti-Semitic voice is becoming louder there.
Bigger, wherever there's a problem, Israel becomes the destination of choice for so many people. Well, Guy, thanks very much. We will talk next week.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with the great restaurateur, Janos Wilder of Janos Restaurant in the J Bar. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi. Please forgive me.
Oh, well, you know, I'm in that business.
I've opened another restaurant.
Downtown?
Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails, 135 South 6th. I got to tell you, I am so excited about it. We have created an absolutely gorgeous space where the former Barrio Grill was located. And the food, well, you know my food.
Your food is the best I've ever had. Don't tell my wife, although she agrees. So you're creating magic food, as she calls it, downtown. What's the best way for people to make reservations to try the new place?
Just give us a call at 623-7700 or go online at downtownkitchen.com. We're serving lunch Monday through Saturday, dinner 7 days a week, happy hour, late night Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and all with prices so low, you can afford to eat here every day.
I would love to. Thanks, Janos.
Thank you, Rabbi.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Israel has done, I think, a really good job of reaching out to what it has perceived as emerging superpowers. Well, at least a very successful job, I think, with India, setting up a lot of nice bilateral ties and exchanges. Not such a successful job with China. What do you see in the future for these huge countries with their enormous populations, now dynamic economies, when we're kind of sputtering along in America?
Well, first of all, I think you've raised, at least implicitly, a long list of subjects there.
Well, good. We can talk for weeks,
Israel's Israel's foreign policy expertise kind of tops the list. And I think Israel is better of necessity at foreign policy than it is at domestic policy. I think Israel's done a good job of reaching out to not only emerging global superpowers, but also regional powers like Turkey. That's been a little bit rocky lately, but over the past decade or so, Israel has done a very good job of cultivating relationships with regional powers to the maximum extent possible, and an extent that has surprised many people and made many people, including many Muslim countries, quite uncomfortable. In terms of China and India, there's a whole complex of questions. First of all, for a long time, we lived in a bipolar world. There were two superpowers after World War II, the U.S. and the Soviet Union. And most countries in the world fell into one camp or another, either through formal alliances or through de facto commercial relationships or cultural relationships or military occupation, whatever the case may have been. When there was briefly and maybe mostly impotently a non-aligned movement run by some giants like Tito and Nasser and Sukarno, it never really amounted to much, although it had a huge population. Now we see countries that were once part of the non-aligned movement coming out of the shadows and acting sometimes on their own, sometimes in concert with others. But countries like Brazil and others that are not yet quite superpowers, but are taking quite constructive steps in the international arena away from big power blocks. There was a vacuum for a while in terms of the U.S. looking like it was the only superpower in the world. And a lot of countries and a lot of people, just ordinary people all over the world, were uncomfortable with a world in which it was one superpower that could be very pushy and that was often perceived as being arrogant and non-consultative. But clearly, over the past decade or so, both China and India have been emerging as superpowers, not only by virtue of their population numbers, which are humongous, but also by virtue of their economic strength and their military strength. And I think we need to examine not only what Israel has done, is doing, and could do with these two emerging superpowers, but also what the U.S. has done, is doing, and could do, possibly in conjunction with or in a complementary fashion to Israel's own overtures, to the extent that we and Israel have shared national interests.
We will continue to examine this question. It's a very interesting one. Big question. Good thing for near the end of the year. When we come back next week. Thanks, Tom.
I look forward to it.
And now it's time for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. Eighty-four-year-old Morris is hit by a car and lies bleeding on the sidewalk. A policeman arrives and, glancing at the victim, immediately calls for an ambulance and a priest. The priest arrives first, and bending over Morris, he asks, "Do you believe in the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost?" Morris lifts his head, opens his eyes wide, turns to the crowd that has gathered. "I'm lying here dying, and this Schmendrick is asking me riddles!" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we begin reading the greatest section of the Torah, the start of the book of Exodus and the portion of Shemot. It starts with the Israelites living well in Egypt, and then a new king arises who knew not Joseph. The people are enslaved, Moses is born, and the fabulous tale of slavery, redemption, and freedom plays out. Nearly from birth, Moses is the most interesting and important person in the Torah, and perhaps in all of world religion. He is courageous, forthright, humble, hot-tempered, persistent, chutzpahdik, in every way a very human hero. At the start of the most important section of this week's portion, Moses is herding sheep in the wilderness when he comes upon a famous bush. Sne bo'er ba'esh ve'asne inenu u'kol. A bush burning with a furious flame, but unconsumed. God appears to Moses out of that flame and instructs him to stand up for his people, to go back to the Egypt he fled as a fugitive, and to try to liberate the enslaved Israelites. But, to put it mildly, Moses is reluctant. He argues he isn't worthy. He says no one will believe him. He tells God he stutters. He comes up with a wide variety of reasons he shouldn't go. When God answers each objection with a solution, Moses eventually concludes by more or less refusing to go. But God has a certain power to persuade. And of course, this being the Torah, our primary religious text, God is right. By the end of the portion, Moses finds himself back in Egypt, his first efforts to liberate the people rebuffed, he himself already discredited in his quest to free his people from domination. The growth of Moses into a protean figure who redeems the Israelites will take two more weekly Torah portions, but the lesson here in Shemot seems to be that if God chooses a course for you, no matter what your personal feelings, you should probably go along for the ride. For one way or another, your direction in life has been selected. The rest, as we say, is just commentary. Or perhaps the lesson is greater. Many times our reluctance to accept a sacred task, to do what we're urged to do, is simply a combination of obstinacy and fear. We know we should choose to take a new course in life, embrace hope and promise over the familiar and the ordinary, but our own inertia holds us back. Ruth Brin's poem on the burning bush puts it well. It was no bush, but Moses' soul touched by the finger of God that flamed and burned. Perhaps in that ecstasy he wished for death. But he burned and was not destroyed. He flared up, but was not consumed. God sent him against his will to the slaves in Egypt. God made him with the fire of faith a wise and mighty leader. For in the light of faith, the mind understands. In the warmth of faith, the heart loves. And in faith, the soul finds its joy. Of all your blessings, God, faith is the first. We beseech you, Lord of all peoples, touch us with your fire. Burn us with your flame. With faith in you, make us whole. Moses required a push from God, a burning bush and a stern command, but we need something simpler. Just a bit of faith and trust in the ultimate triumph of love. May we each find that in the coming week. When we come back on Two Jewish in a few moments, the renowned professor and author Robert Putnam will explain what it is that makes Americans so religious and why.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Our brothers, Richard Holbrooke, a forceful presence in American diplomacy for more than 45 years, died last week in Washington. He was 69. Holbrooke, who served in the Obama administration as the U.S. Special Representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan, was putting the finishing touches on a major report on the American military and diplomatic efforts in Afghanistan, due to be released shortly. Family members said his last words before he headed into surgery were, "You've got to stop this war in Afghanistan." President Obama called Holbrooke's widow, the best-selling author and journalist Kathy Martin, a former guest of Too Jewish, to express condolences and publicly toasted Holbrooke as a public servant in the truest sense. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton called Holbrooke one of America's fiercest champions in a statement. "He was one of a kind, a true statesman, and that makes his passing all the more painful." Richard Holbrooke had actually been in Secretary of State Clinton's office when he collapsed. Among his many accomplishments, Holbrooke, who also wrote part of the Pentagon Papers, is best known for brokering the Dayton Accords that ended the Balkan War of the mid-1990s and for serving as U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. Although born to two Jewish parents, Holbrooke's upbringing was essentially non-religious, but he was very supportive of Kathy Martin, his wife's discovery of her own hidden Jewish background. And in a story that I find somewhat unnerving, Samuel T. Cohen, the physicist who invented the small tactical nuclear weapon known as the neutron bomb, the controversial device that killed enemy troops with subatomic particles but left battlefields and cities intact, died at his home in Los Angeles. He was 89. Unlike Robert Oppenheimer and Edward Teller, the fathers of the atomic and hydrogen bombs, Cohen was not well known outside of government and scientific circles, although his work for years influenced the international debate over the deployment and potential use of nuclear arms. In contrast to strategic warheads, which can kill millions and level cities, and smaller short-range tactical nuclear arms designed to wipe out battlefield forces, the neutron bomb minimized blast and heat. It maximized instead a barrage of infinitesimal neutrons that zipped through tanks, buildings, and other structures and killed people, usually by destroying the central nervous system, oh, and by the way, all other life forms. A specialist in the radiological effects of nuclear weapons, Cohen relentlessly promoted the neutron bomb for much of his life, writing books and articles, conferring with presidents and cabinet officials, taking his case to congressional committees, scientific bodies, and international forums. He won many converts, but ultimately failed to persuade the United States or anyone else to integrate the device into its tactical nuclear arsenal. The Reagan administration did develop but never deployed the neutron bomb weapons of the 80s. France, Israel, and the Soviet Union were believed to have added versions of the bomb to their arsenals. Western military planners rejected their use in Vietnam and regarded them only as a possible deterrent to Soviet tank forces in Europe. But the end of the Cold War obviated even that purpose for the neutron bomb. The last great push for the neutron bomb was in 1981, when President Ronald Reagan ordered 700 neutron warheads to oppose Soviet tank forces in Europe. He called it the first weapon that's come along in a long time that could easily and economically alter the balance of power. But deployment to the NATO alliance was canceled after a storm of anti-nuclear protests around Europe. Eventually, President George Bush the Elder ordered the stockpile scrapped. By 1982, Samuel Cohen had abandoned his deployment quest for the neutron bomb, but he continued for the rest of his life to defend it as practical and humane. "It's the most sane moral weapon ever devised," he said recently. "It's the only nuclear weapon in history that makes sense in waging war. When the war is over, the world is still intact." Wow. And in the latest look at Who's Marrying a Jew, this time from the Republican perspective, a granddaughter of former President George H.W. Bush the Elder is engaged to marry the son of the famed Jewish fashion designer Ralph Lauren. Fashion model Lauren Pierce Bush, daughter of presidential brother and son Neil Bush, and a niece of former President George W. Bush the Younger, is engaged to David Lauren, an executive in the fashion industry. Lauren's original name, of course, is Ralph Reuben Lifshitz. He is, Jewish. The announcement comes just 6 months after Chelsea Clinton married Jewish investment banker Mark Mizvinsky in the ceremony that raised a great deal of discussion, even here on Too Jewish. And that's the news of Jews round the world. We're delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Robert Putnam. He is the author of the seminal book, Bowling Alone, about the collapse and revival of American community, Better Together, Restoring the American Community, and with David Campbell, his new book, The Really Wonderful American Grace, which, by the way, is not a small or light little book. It's a tome of 600 and some pages with lots of footnotes, and yet it's really compelling reading. So we were talking about what it is that makes America a place in which we are both pious, that may not be the exact word, but we are religiously active and yet tolerant of, we're devout and diverse, I think was your very nice way of putting it. What are besides the Bill of Rights, the basic legal structure, which we had in the 19th century and it didn't help much, what is it that is true in America today that makes it possible?
Well, let me just for a second give some of the evidence that America really is pretty religiously tolerant. We asked everybody, would you say, everybody in America, with this is a big national, rationally representative survey, 3,000 people. We ask everybody, would you say that, give them three choices, there is one religion which is true and others are not true. We can call that the true believer option. Or would you say that there is very little truth in any religion? We can call that the anti-religion or atheist option, or that there are many truths, there are basic truths in many religions, and we can call that, in a sense, the tolerant option. And if you listen to talk radio or you know read about culture wars in America, you might think that all Americans are either in the first camp, that is, the my way or the highway camp, or the last camp, they really are hostile to religion entirely. But actually, only about 8% of Americans say that there's no truth in any religion, and only about 10 or 12% of Americans say that there's one true religion, theirs, and more than 80% of Americans say there's basic truths in every religion. Even people who are very religious, let's say evangelical conservatives, most of them say that there are basic truths in many religions. When we ask people whether someone who's not of their faith can nevertheless go to heaven, overwhelming majorities of Americans, 80 to 90% of Americans say that, yes, someone who's a good person but not of my faith can go to heaven. And we thought, well, maybe that's, you know, a few Methodists saying that a couple of Presbyterians might be able to make it in. But so when we were talking to Christians who said, yes, that people not of their faith could go to heaven, we went on to say, well, how about non-Christians? Can a good non-Christian get to heaven?
You mean like a Jew?
Yeah, exactly. And there's a right answer to that question if you believe in Orthodox Christianity. I mean, Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the light. Except through me, there is no access to the Father. Pretty clear. It's my way or, you know, sadly, the highway. But a majority, even of evangelical Christians, say that a good person who's not a Christian can nevertheless be saved or go to heaven. And so the question is, I mean, when I talk to evangelical theologians about that, they're appalled because they say, how in the world did these, all of our flock, miss the point? Were they just not there for that lesson in which we made clear that other people in other religions are, you know, they're okay, but they're not going to be saved? And here's the answer, I think, Rabbi. Over the last 50 or 60 years, Americans have become much more closely integrated in personal terms with people of other faiths. The intermarriage rate, for example, marriages across religious lines, is now so high that most American marriages today, most American weddings today, involve interfaith marriages. So the marriage between Chelsea Clinton and her Jewish husband is nowadays completely normal. And I can tell you that 50 years ago, though, that was not at all completely normal. And so lots of us have family across religious lines. Lots of us change our religions. And about a third of all Americans are worshiping in some religion other than their own parents' religion. So we no longer inherit religion. About half of all of our closest friends are in some other religion. So it's very hard to demonize other religions if we know personally and love someone who's in a different religion from us. And we, in the book, we speak about Aunt Susan. Everybody's got an Aunt Susan. Aunt Susan is something other than me. I mean, I'm Jewish and Aunt Susan is Catholic, or I'm Catholic and Aunt Susan is evangelical, or I'm evangelical and Aunt Susan is Mormon or something. And I know that my faith says, poor Aunt Susan, she's not going to make it to heaven. She just doesn't pray at the right place. But on the other hand, believe me, I know Aunt Susan. If anyone's going to heaven, it's Aunt Susan. She's made for heaven. So all Americans are caught between the formal strictures of their religion and Aunt Susan, and Aunt Susan almost always wins.
What a fantastic illustration. You know, one of the most fun charts in this book, which has, by the way, a lot of great dialogue and narrative, but also a lot of great data. My favorite chart, maybe of all, is which religious group is warm or cold to whom? And,
right.
You know, obviously everybody rates themselves the warmest.
Yep.
But it was fascinating. You came up with a great point. Almost everyone likes mainline Protestants and Jews. Boy,
yep.
Have we come a long way.
I have to tell you, Rabbi, in that chart, which we show that among all the religious groups in America, Jews are rated by non-Jews higher than anybody else. Catholics are rated pretty high by non-Catholics. As you say, mainline Protestants, that is, you know, Methodists and Presbyterians and so on, are rated high by people outside that faith, but highest of all are the Jews. And I'm Jewish, and I was speaking to my own congregation about our book and these findings. And for most of the talk, you know, they're my own fellow congregants, so they're proud of me, and that was great. They said, Bob, that's wonderful. Except, you don't get it, Bob. It isn't true that non-Jews like us. They actually hate us, and you just didn't find it out.
And because you're such a poor researcher, really.
Well, but look, this is the point. Of course there has been vicious anti-Semitism in America in the past, and I do not mean that anti-Semitism has disappeared from America. But we Jews should not be blind to the fact that there is a hugely great, I mean, we encounter a hugely greater tolerance than we used to, and you know, there's another kind of humorous example of this. It turns out on online dating services, you have to tell your characteristics, you know, I'm tall or short or I'm, you know, educated or not educated, and you say what religion you are. Jews are the most popular dates on online dating services among non-Jews. Now, why is that? It's because, well, of course, we're handsome and smart and
yes,
everything.
Yes, of course, and good providers, too. That's
and good providers, right?
Right.
But it used to be that would not have been enough. Nobody would have said, no non-Jew would have said, oh, just above all, I'm looking to marry a Jew. But that older set of prejudices has largely begun to disappear, partly because more people have Jewish Aunt Susans, and partly because, frankly, of the Holocaust. The Holocaust was a disaster in many ways, but it also was a death knell for overt anti-Semitism. It became impossible politically for people to express publicly anti-Semitism, and that gradually began to smother anti-Semitism, because you couldn't pass it on to your own. If you were anti-Semitic, it would be hard to pass it on to your own kids because you couldn't talk about it. I want to be clear, I don't mean that there's no anti-Semitism. Of course there is, but I think the Jews are a very good example of how the last 50, 60, 70 years have actually brought a surprising degree of interfaith, you know, tolerance and willingness to live together.
You know, it's kind of stunning. I was watching the movie, Barry Levinson's movie, Liberty Heights, which is a wonderful film about growing up in Baltimore in the 50s. And the
yep.
kids are standing outside of a country club looking at the sign. And the sign says, no Jews, dogs,
right.
or coloreds allowed.
Right.
That was common. By the way, there's a great discussion. They decide, well, how do they decide what order to put that in? You know? How do you decide you hate Jews more than dogs or blacks? You know, it's a, so I mean that was an
close call.
yeah, tough. Can't side. So you know, that was, what about Jewish dogs? Anyway, it was a very tough, you know, that was a very common experience in the 50s.
Right.
I hear about from people. Boy, it surely isn't now.
Right.
Besides the Holocaust, because that, after all, was post-Holocaust. What other trends are there for Jews that we should know, besides the fact that some people say we're being loved to death by America?
Well, you know, there is this complicated question for the, I'm now just speaking as a Jew and for the Jewish community, this book is not written just for Jews, it's written for all Americans to kind of provide a mirror of how we've been changing over the last 50 years, and the big headline stories are that we've become both more polarized in religious terms, and also more tolerant in religious terms. The contradiction there is that in public terms, when you look at our public debate, it sounds like, you know, we're divided into two countries, and the two sides just cannot possibly get along, the religious people and the non-religious people. But when you talk about people's own personal lives, it's a completely different world. People all the time are interacting with, and as I say, loving people of different religions. The issue, I think, the most interesting issue for Jews that comes out of our research is that it's perfectly clear that intermarriage and connections with non-Jews have been good for the standing of Jews in America. On the other hand, of course, for any minority, marrying outside the faith raises the risk of the faith just disappearing, so to speak, because, you know, if a Jew and a non-Jew get married, maybe they don't raise their kids Jewish. Now, if you'll forgive me, just a personal reference, I was not raised as a Jew. I was raised as a Methodist. I converted to Judaism about 50 years ago, and when I met a lovely woman who's still my wife, and she was Jewish, and I converted, and we raised our kids as Jews, and they both married non-Jews, which we could hardly object to, given our history, and one of their spouses converted, and all six of our grandchildren are now being bar mitzvahed, bat mitzvahed. So I personally am responsible for a minion.
I'm saying mazel tov. That's a great model for contemporary Judaism, actually. No longer the ghetto, now it's the minion.
Right.
So, you know, and that, of course, is a reflection of some of the dramatic changes in acceptance and people, Judaism becoming more welcoming as well, of course.
Absolutely. Very important.
I felt like we could go on for a great deal longer, but sort of one final thought. You expressed quite beautifully at the end of the book that the real grace of America is the interlocking personal relationships that transcend religion, perhaps married to the legal protection of religion.
Correct.
And the absence of religion as an instrument of state.
Yep.
Any other magic pieces that other countries could follow?
I want to make clear, all of those things, despite what you might think if you listen to talk radio or cable television or whatever, the vast majority of Americans are comfortable with all of those things. The number of Americans who want to impose their religion on other people is really small, maybe 10% of all Americans. But even most of the most publicly, the groups in America that are most publicly identified with religion, I mean with religiosity, so to speak, evangelical Protestants, most of them do not want to impose their views on everybody else. It's not what you'd think from the media, but actually it's not true. And conversely, most secular Americans are not trying to make America an irreligious place. Most of the secular people in America say when we ask them, they think religion is basically a force for good in America. So we're actually much less divided than we think we are. We're very divided politically, and that's frankly a disaster. I'm really worried about how divided we are politically. Different story and maybe a different book sometime, but in religious terms, our message is sort of, relax. We are all much more reasonable than you might think we were if you just looked in the funhouse mirror of the public media.
What a great message. The book is called American Grace, Robert Putnam and David Campbell. I strongly recommend it. Thank you, Bob, for a great visit on Too Jewish, and mazel tov on, you know, your bar mitzvah minion.
Thanks very much. I appreciate it, Rabbi.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Attention Arizona taxpayers! You can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime by directing your tax dollars to the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization, formerly known as CATER. Here's how. The State of Arizona Private School Tax Credit allows Arizona taxpayers to get a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations, allowing scholarships for children in kindergarten through 12th grade to attend qualified private schools. JETCO helps provide a quality Jewish education to children in need at the Tucson Hebrew Academy and the Jewish Community Center. If you make your donation today, you'll get 100% of your money back on your Arizona state income tax. A tax credit is not a deduction. Rather, it's money that comes directly back to you in your state tax return. To direct your tax dollars to Jewish education today, please call 647-8442. That's 647-8442. Or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. The deadline to take your tax credit is December 31st, so call or sign up online now.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Next week, our guest will be Al Jaffe, the famed Mad Magazine illustrator and comic author that so many of us grew up on, and many teens still do. Our playout this morning comes from Rabbi Joe Black. He'll be at Temple Emmanuel in Tucson, Arizona, where I live, this coming Friday night for Chardonnay Shabbat services at 5:45. His song is called Two Prayers. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
May it be beautiful before me. May it be beautiful behind me. May it be beautiful below.
The preceding program was produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.